This is local and regional news on KMUN. It's Wednesday, February 25th. I'm Skylar Butenchen.
And I'm Katie Frankowitz. Camps in downtown Astoria have multiplied and in some cases become more elaborate in recent months, with people using wooden pallets to lift their tents and positions off the ground and keep things dry. Moved from an area near county administrative offices in Astoria, campers set up across from the Astoria Library or near the American Legion building, and then they move around again. Last year, a majority of the Astoria City Council rejected a proposed ordinance that would have banned people from parts of downtown, except under specific circumstances, if they broke certain rules or repeatedly violated the city's camping ordinance. Some city councilors worried the ordinance unfairly targeted homeless people, but they still agreed something needs to be done downtown. Police have said enforcement of city rules around the unhoused population remains a challenge. Now the city council is considering a designated campsite, similar to Stepping Stones in Seaside, where homeless campers can set up their living areas and are not forced to move every day.
For me, having a designated campsite is something I'm very supportive of. I think that there's a completely separate question of where the appropriate place for a designated campsite is, but I think that visiting the model that's down in Seaside, talking to some of the people there, talking to the staff, I think that that seems like a viable step toward more safe and secure unsheltered existence for some of the people that are currently on the street and that we're just effectively chasing around all the time.
That's City Councilor Andy Davis, speaking at a council meeting Monday night. He and other city councilors said they are concerned about how the city finances a permanent site. A staff report estimates that a designated campsite could come with a total startup cost between $180,000 and $290,000. A permanent site would come with garbage services and portable restrooms, and the city would be looking to provide support services for campers. City Councilor Elizabeth Adams has generally not supported creating a specific camping area.
But again, our current situation is not working. It is creating undue hardship for people who are living on the street and for people who are trying to help people living on the street. Creating undue hardship for our community to feel pitted against each other and whether or not they are, whether or not their values are important or aligned with others.
The City Council hopes to hold a work session next week to further discuss Seaside's model of a designated camping site and plans to have something on the agenda at a future meeting. City Councilors said on Monday that they are moving ahead one step at a time. So far, no possible sites for the campsite have been identified. The city will also need to take another look at its current camping ordinance that outlines when, where, and how people are allowed to camp in Astoria. I'm Katie Frankowitz, reporting for KMUN.
The Astoria Trolley started running up and down the city's waterfront almost 30 years ago, attracting all kinds of businesses and visitors. But the actual line is much, much older and in need of repair. The trouble is, maintenance has to happen among the sea lions that hang out under the trestles, and they're federally protected. Christian Fodenwenzel has this report.
When Frank Kemp retired from the Navy, he and his wife looked for the perfect coastal spot to spend their golden years.
Astoria was the last town we could find that's a real town still. It's not completely tourism, if you know what I mean. Still got lumbering, fishing, all that stuff.
They loved the gritty atmosphere and all the history. It wasn't long until Kemp started volunteering at the Astoria Riverfront Trolley. It's an historic railroad that used to ship Astoria's canned salmon and logs out to the world. But by the 1990s, those industries were a shell of their former selves, as was Astoria's waterfront in general. The old rail line ran from one closed-up cannery to the next, past shuttered mills and half-empty docks. It was not exactly a tourist destination. But If you squinted past all the dilapidation, there were the most fantastic views of the Columbia River, massive ocean-going ships, sea lions, and the green hills of Washington. The city opened a river walk and hoped that might attract visitors.
There was a push on to get rid of the tracks so that the river walk could be wider.
But Astorians wanted to remain true to their industrial roots, so they kept the tracks and instead added a trolley. It proved a real success, attracting curious visitors who in turn inspired new restaurants, breweries, shops, and hotels.
We run in teams of two. One drives and one handles the money, lets people on and off, and does a narration the whole way. Yeah, for instance, this end of town used to be called Finntown, because when the place was first settled, the Finns settled on the west end of Astoria, and the Norwegians, Danes, and Swedes settled in Upper Town.
Now, the seasonal trolley gives visitors a fascinating glimpse of a busy industrial waterfront that's both scenic and rings true to the old Astorian spirit that's best summarized in the old bumper sticker, "We Ain't Quaint." But there's a problem. The rail line on which the trolley runs dates back to the 1940s and was built of wood, a material that doesn't do great sitting right on the water's edge. Astoria city engineer Nathan Crater walks down to one riverfront trestle, past a crumbling old factory, a new hotel, and a homeless camp. Each trestle is made up of big wooden pilings, like telephone poles but bigger, that were pounded into the mud 70 or 80 years ago. Most are fine, but some are rotten. Workers will knock on them to check, and when they come across a rotten one, they'll cut it out, usually down to the waterline, because lower than that and the wood hasn't been exposed to oxygen, so it's good. They'll bolt a metal beam onto that good wood, then tie the pile back into the trestle. The city doesn't have the money to cover all $1.6 million worth of work, but they'll do the crucial stuff now and catch the other issues later. But there's another problem. Scores of sea lions have made a home under the trestles, and sea lions are federally protected, which means they can't be killed, captured, or even harassed. Crater says luckily the trestles they're about to work on are well away from the sea lion's main gathering area, and workers will be very careful.
We generally can slowly migrate down to the area, and they will basically avoid us. They don't want to be close to us any more than we want to be right next to them.
Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell.
The trolley's scheduled to reopen next month in time for spring break. Be careful, because the rails, the bike lane, and the walking trail are all one and the same. And to take a ride, just wave a dollar bill at the driver.
Bump, bump, bump went the brake.
I'm Christian Fodenwenzel reporting.
The Astoria Parks and Recreation Department is at the halfway point in developing its master plan, which will guide the department's goals over the next 10 years. Parks Director Jonah Dart McLean says he received 1,000 responses from the community in a recent online survey that laid out 8 potential city projects. 2 of those projects rose to the top, an expansion to the Astoria Aquatic Center and an off-leash dog park. Most community members were aligned concerning the Aquatic Center expansion, with over 500 people asking for it to be completed within 2 years. The proposal for an off-leash dog area, which would potentially be located in Tapiola Park, was more controversial. The project had the highest number of do not support votes, with over 200, but it also received over 300 responses asking for it to be completed within 2 years. Dart McLean says the topic of dog parks in Astoria has been hotly debated since before he joined the department in 2014. The next open house meeting on all of the proposed park projects is scheduled for March 7th. A final meeting will be held sometime in April. The Astoria City Council voted last week to increase the Astoria Column's annual parking fee from $5 to $10. The change will take effect in May. The Friends of the Astoria Column Group recommended the new parking price earlier this year in order to keep up with maintenance and preservation costs for the structure. The Friends Group estimates that maintenance and preservation costs could be as much as $1.5 million over the next 10 to 15 years. Executive Director of the Clatsop County Historical Society, Mac Burns, says there is a plan to manage the impact the fees could have on locals. Parking fees will drop back to $5 during December and January. Burns says this will encourage locals to get their passes renewed each year. These stories come to us through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyastorian.com. The pandemic changed how many of us work. It also seems to have changed the nature of volunteerism as well. As KLCC's Karen Richards reports, some local organizations have been able to adapt, while others face challenges.
A January 2026 Gallup poll found that 63% of people volunteer their time to a religious or nonprofit organization each year. That's up from 56% in 2021, but Diana Mason, the director of the University of Oregon's Master's in Nonprofit Management program, says the shape of volunteering is different now.
I think there's been a trending change over the past decade of more online volunteering, more episodic volunteering. So folks who are volunteering just for one event or a couple days, rather than sort of these long-term multi-year volunteers.
Mason says the pool of volunteers is generally more diverse, younger, and looking for a different kind of experience. This parallels the direction of employment generally, with increases in remote and hybrid work. The new landscape hits some organizations harder than others. Leah Chisholm oversees Lane County's Meals on Wheels program, as well as 9 senior meal centers. She says their daily in-person service requires dedicated and consistent volunteers.
We average about 200 active at any given time. However, it seems like a big number. Before the pandemic, we had more than 500 within the program.
Chisholm says the volunteer deficit is especially tough for Meals on Wheels.
We've had to really look at maybe having a longer route. Sometimes it's asking volunteers to give more time or drive more miles, and that's a big ask.
Some nonprofits have been able to flex to fit the changes in the volunteer pool. Leanne Locker is OSU Extension's statewide Master Gardener Outreach Coordinator.
Thanks to the pandemic, online education jumped to being acceptable and doable. We offer trainings for our volunteers in a variety of different ways, which means we're able to attract more people, you know, not just folks who are retired and have more time.
Locker says the program offers online training, Zoom workshops, and weekend in-person meetings. However, she says the program doesn't offer many one-time or short-term volunteer opportunities.
One thing is making sure that people know that when they sign up to be a Master Gardener volunteer, that it is not just getting the education and playing in the garden, but it's serving the community and answering gardening questions and volunteering in the garden or volunteering in your community. So the first year, it's a commitment.
Locker says to start, the program requires 40 hours of class time and 40 hours of volunteering. The next year, it's 30 hours of volunteering and education. She says it's a challenge to control the drop-off rates. Mason with U of O says having a dedicated volunteer coordinator is key.
The search for volunteers is never ending, right? And volunteers come and they go. And so a lot of the effort is actually spent on trying to retain them too. So if you have a good volunteer, like, don't let them leave.
She says if possible, a nonprofit should meet volunteers where they are and offer tasks that match their motivations. That may be office work to build a young person's resume or social tasks to help someone make connections.
I always tell my students that volunteers are not free. They take a lot of work and resources and capacity of the organization to recruit, train, manage, and retain.
While Mason says recruiting remains largely through personal connections and word of mouth, Locker says having Master Gardener workshops available on YouTube and other platforms has helped bring in new volunteers.
Being visible introduces us to more people, and maybe it shows them a side of the program that they may not have known about.
Chisholm says they're always thinking of creative ways to find people who want to give back, especially in rural Lane County.
So social media, our website, public service announcements. We recently sent a letter of introduction to all of the churches within Lane County.
And some legalities continue to change to fit the times. Chisholm says a new regulation is in the works that would allow more flexible scheduling for some volunteers. She says offering food to go, which was a temporary exception during the pandemic, should be an option for some senior meals by the end of the year. I'm Karen Richards reporting.
Port of Peninsula Executive Director Jay Personius recently announced his resignation. The announcement comes just a year and a half after a Washington State audit identified financial mismanagement, Open Public Meetings Act violations, and other problems at the port. Commissioner Chuck Mikula said Personius' resignation came as a surprise to him and the other two Port of Peninsula commissioners, Phil Martin and John Oakes. Despite the issues brought up by state auditors and an earlier conflict with the Washington State Department of Ecology, Personius pointed to accomplishments in his resignation letter during his 12 years at the port. He served as executive director for the last 9 years. Personius said the Port of Peninsula is in solid financial shape, with less than $300,000 in low-interest outside debt and a capital project account balance of over $2.3 million. He also indicated the port will be able to provide the state with what it needs to comply with an upcoming follow-up audit. Personius will serve in his position as executive director until March 31st. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. $100,000 originally designated for community policing in Spokane will now go to direct assistance to immigrant and refugee families. Spokane City Council approved an ordinance Monday to grant those dollars to the Spokane Immigrant Rights Coalition. The group is made up of 9 local nonprofits. The coalition says it'll use the money to help local immigrant families with emergency needs like transportation, rent, legal fees, or food. Multiple council members say this is a unique step from the police department to build trust with community members. Here's Council President Betsy Wilkerson.
I really want to thank Chief Hall for looking at his budget, his community engagement support funding, and saying there is more to policing than just arresting people. There is actually taking care of people.
Progressive advocacy group Fuse Washington was originally a fiscal sponsor of the grant. But according to a statement from the coalition, when the city made it clear that no funds could be used for lobbying efforts, Fuse stepped away. The fiscal sponsor is now Muslims for Community Action and Support. This is KMUN News. You're listening to KMUN. Up next, the American Democracy Minute. Stay tuned after that for the Ship Report with Joanne Rideout. Thanks for listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We're back in Utah today, where on February 23rd, a federal district court panel rejected a GOP appeal to court-chosen fair congressional districts. Another GOP appeal failed in the Utah Supreme Court last week. As we've reported, the Utah legislature has systematically attempted to neutralize the voter-approved Proposition 4 constitutional amendment, enshrining a fair and independent redistricting process. After years of trying to replace fairer maps with manipulated ones and passing legislation undermining the citizen initiative, Utah state courts consistently rejected the legislature's efforts as unconstitutional. In December, 3rd District Court Judge Diana Gibson chose a fairer map by the League of Women Voters and Mormon Women for Ethical Government over the Utah legislature's top choice. February 20th, the Utah Supreme Court rejected a GOP appeal of the map, saying it came too late. Monday, a 3-judge U.S. District Court panel rejected the state GOP's claim that it was the legislature's sole duty to create the map. The court also noted that any changes would come too close to the election per the Purcell principle. So after years of plots to subvert the voters, it seems that Utah will get a fairer congressional map after all. We've linked to the federal court decision and more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal. Find us on Blue Sky at Democracy Minute.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN news team. That includes me, host and producer Skylar Butenchen, and news director Katie Frankowitz.